Accession number 9420, reel 7.
Mr. Bill Gilman, Reel 7. We were talking about conditions during a typical day in this period on the Somme front. Would you get any chance to get to sleep during some sleep in during the day?
Yes, you did, because you were on the usual duty of 2 on and 4 off right through the night, you see, and of course we acted in a platoon fashion. We were our own little platoon who shared those duties. And because of that, we needed some sleep during the day. And as you couldn't leave, this is in the front line I'm talking about now, and as you couldn't leave the front line for any other purpose, you just had to sneak your rest if you needed it. A lot depended on the amount of... And if you went out on wiring party, you know, with the engineers while they were repairing the wire, and...
Would you sleep in the dugouts?
Yes, because we used to have the dugouts in the side of the trench, of the trenches, in those places where it was deep enough, and it varied a lot. The trenches were never the same. The formation was the same, the zigzag pattern. But the depth of them made all the difference between there being dugouts or not. And usually they'd already been there when we got there. They'd been created already.
Did you have any, during the day, did you have any special duties that you had to do? Were you an officer's servant or a runner or anything?
No. We were strictly confined to the trench, and it was stand to if there were any warnings or of any kind of... possible raids or suspected raids, you just there were on call immediately.
What did you do as a sentry, both during the day and night? What was your job as a sentry then?
As a sentry, you stood too on the fire step. There was a fire step in all the forward bays in the zigzag pattern of the trenches, you know, and they all had fire steps, which were about 2 feet above the floor of the trench. And you used to stand on those with your rifle over the parapet, facing the no man's land. And that's where you had to keep your eyes skinned all the time and be alert and watchful.
How did you look over the top of the trench? Did you
just in the normal way, unless we had warnings about snipers or nasty spots, which we had to keep our heads down, then you didn't put your head up then. But we never had such things as periscopes or anything like that, you know, to watch you. It was always direct vision over the top of the trench.
Did you have any trouble staying awake, either during the day or night?
No, that's why you were very careful about getting the rest. Because if you needed the rest, you knew it was essential. You never knew what was going to be involved. And therefore, you obeyed the nature's demands, I suppose, that if you felt very tired as a result of a very exhausting night of any kind, sometimes you had to be particularly vigilant, especially if Jerry was sending up very signals when you knew that he'd got patrols out, or if he thought that we'd got patrols out. And then you had to keep your eyes skinned then, in case of any movement from enemy patrols.
As sentry, did you ever see any German movement? Or?
No. No, we could hear them, though. We could hear them in certain parts of the line that we occupied. You know, you could hear the voices. And I expect they could hear us. But one very important thing that we were always warned about was lighting matches or cigarettes or anything like that. And that because you could see a spark of light hundreds of yards away, and you could reveal your presence quite easily.
During the night, this was when you said most of the activity and working parties, took place. What sort of working parties would you be on during the night?
Always engineers covering. My job was covering engineers, repairing the wire. This was later on that I used to do this, not early on, because when I went out on covering parties, it was when I had a Lewis gun. And I can remember sometimes it was so quiet there that I almost dozed off, I must admit, with your chin resting on the butt of the gun, you know, and just waiting and watching. And, of course, it was a very tiring job, in a way, from a senses point of view.
Did you ever go on covering parties while you were an ordinary infantryman, before you got your Lewis gun training?
Oh, yes. Well, you were still an infantryman, even though you were Lewis gun, but it was only an added section or weapon supplying that made you any different to a gun. Because in a gun formation, you had six men, rather.
We'll come to the Lewis gun side, when we get to that point in the story. When you were just, before you got the Lewis gun, then, how were the covering
parties? Didn't go out on any covering parties while I was an infantryman with an ordinary rifle, but went out on patrols then instead.
What can you tell me about the patrols? What was the purpose of the patrol?
Purpose of the patrols was really to find out the presence of the enemy or where near he was. And to see if you could get hold of anybody in the and the get near the trenches, you see, sufficiently near. I never got into any action on patrols at all when I went out.
What preparations would you make before you went on?
Well, you always blacked your buttons and made sure your buttons and your bayonets were black too, because you always had your bayonets fixed when you went out.
What did you use to do to black this?
I don't know. It was a kind of dubbing stuff that didn't shine. It was a dull black, and it didn't reflect any light at all. It was quite good for that angle. And of course, the slightest glint or reflection showed up, especially if a very light went up when you was out on patrol. And when you was out, sometimes the very lights would go up because they had a suspicion there was something going on. And then we've had to. As the very light's gone up, we've been taking a step and still keep our feet like that up in the air until the very light dropped down and burnt. If it was quite near to you sometimes, amazingly enough, they never seem to see you because they never open fire, and I've been quite near very lights when they've dropped nearby.
What weapons would you take with you into no man's land?
Just grenades and a rifle only.
How did you carry the grenades?
They were in the your pouches. You could add them in the pouches, you know. Or you could hook them on if you'd got any hooks, because there's a ring on the top, you know, of the grenades. And it was just a question of knowing where they were, that you could drop your hand instantly on them and pull the pin out and sling them if it was necessary.
Did you use any makeshift weapons for
no.
hitting? It was just rifle and...
Just the ordinary armament that was issued to us and we relied on.
How many would go out in one of these reconnaissance patrols?
Only about five or six on a patrol.
And who would command it?
Oh, a corporal or a sergeant, all depends who was, what the size of the patrol was. It varied from sometimes five to six to eight men, but it wasn't standard. I mean, a lot was determined by the conditions and what they knew about the state of the front and when we took over from the previous regiment, because we used to relieve one another, you see. And we had about 2 to 3 weeks in the line.
And what was it like in no man's land, moving about no man's land, typically?
Well, you could only do that of a night time.
I mean on the patrols.
Oh, yes, on the patrols. Well, you had to... You followed one another, really, because you've got to keep in touch. That was the main thing. You could easily get lost in the dark, and you've got to be prepared and keep your mouth shut, to make no noise and be careful what you were doing. You were on a constant state of alert, tense alertness, and you alive to every sound that might reveal anything. That's why sometimes you used to get a bit jerky if rats were about there, because they used to make noises that could sound like an enemy. If you were in doubt, of course, you'd drop to the ground, and if it became certain that you got something in front of you, you open fire.
But that didn't happen to you, though?
No, I never experienced any of that.
What was the ground like underfoot, so to speak?
This was the one of the things that you always had to be very careful about, especially when there was a noise-making involved. It was the shell holes and bits of wire and all this kind of thing. You had to be so alive to every possible thing that could cause sound to reveal your presence, because Jerry was very alert. That's how I always found him anyway when I was with the lads, and obviously self-preservation was the first instinct. So
was it overgrown, or was it basically a mud surface?
It was battered. Most of it was war torn. That's why there were shell holes all over the place, and as I say, these obstructions of barbed wire and the usual wreckage of war-torn area. And there was no grass could grow there because it was turned up and smashed up, and what trees there was in some parts of the front was mere stunted growth, you know, that had been ripped and by shells and all, no foliage at all.
How close to the German lines would you go on a typical patrol?
You could never tell. Although sometimes you could hear voices get clearer as you got nearer to the front. You see the line, the German lines, and that was the only way you could really tell where they were, because they were on duty 2 on and 4 off, the same as we were, I suppose, and they were on the lookout for us as we were with them.
Now, who commanded you during one of these trips, the patrols?
The corporal, the NCO, always an NCO, never an officer, and they took us out. Unless it was a big patrol, and it was a semi-operation, you know, with an objective in view.
Did you ever go on one of those?
No.
Were you ever involved either at the receiving end or doling it out of a raid during this period up to...
No, I never was, fortunately. I don't know whether fortune smiled on me or not, but it was a question of detail. You were detailed to go on these raids and patrols, and I just wasn't. Not on a raid, anyway.
You say you were detailed. For an ordinary night patrol, you'd just be told...
Well, the sergeant used to come along, you see, all the sergeant made you according to where you were and the conditions under which you existed in the trench at the time, and your formation and the strength of the regiment, because that determined it quite a bit on the numbers that were involved. And the sergeant used to come along, or the sergeant major, according to the rank involved in it, according to orders from battalion headquarters, and he just detailed you to raid tonight. You're on a patrol tonight.
Would he pick out people who were used to it and good at it, or would it just be anyone?
No, haphazard, you know, everybody got... You just got picked out and sent, and, of course, he did pay attention sometimes to the old sweats, who obviously were always a good... I used to look up to those men because they knew their onions, they knew all the snags and what to look for and or to look out for, and I used to be careful and listen to them, you know. You soon found out that you didn't know it all, and there's quite a lot that you didn't know, and you were reminded by them, if you started slinging your weight about, that you've only just come up, you know. This was the attitude.
Did you have any other jobs or duties that you had to do at night other than these patrols?
No, you sometimes were called on to help out with the rations, carrying or going back to get rations or anything like that, according to what was needed at the time and thought to be necessary.
I'd like to look now at the sort of routine fighting. I don't think routine's a good word, but the sort of day-to-day fighting that would go on. Firstly, the artillery fire you'd get in this period of time.
Well, you'd get occasional barrages, and you got, of course, you'd always get machine gun bursts from...
Well, t- sticking to artillery, what was it? What do you mean by occasional barrages? What did that involve?
Well, if for some reason Jerry thought that there was any movement or preparation for a movement, for attack or anything like that, he'd open up a barrage, either heavy or light, according to whether the operation was serious or whether he intended to attack.
What was
it
like?
He always preceded his attacks with a barrage.
What was it like in one of these barrages? Could you describe
it? Oh, they came over, you know, and there was a mixture of whiz-bangs and light artillery and heavy artillery in some cases. It all depended on the nature of the front, really. And they ranged from light guns, like whiz-bangs, which were the lightest of the artillery, to 9.2s. They were the heaviest we knew about. And they were murderous things, and they had a terrific explosion. And the size of the shell, being 9.2, when it exploded, it used to break up into splinters about the size of my hand, and it used to whirl round in a horizontal fashion when they exploded, for some reason or the other. That was one of those that sliced my mate's head off alongside of me.
Was that during this period?
No, that was in the August on the 8th, and we were waiting to go over for the final assault.
What did you feel and what did you do during one of these barrages?
We just kept your head down. There was only one rule when a barrage was on, that was to keep your head down.
Where would you take shelter? At the bottom of the trench or
in the dugout? You just duck below the level, the ground level, because that was the only chance. You couldn't protect yourself in a trench. If anything, in other words, if it was a shell exploded over the top of the trench and you were underneath it, that was it. You didn't know anything more about it, and that was the end of that. And on one occasion, actually, a whiz-bang, I think it was a whiz-bang, shell came over and went into the opposite side of the trench behind us. And it was sticking there. We looked at it, and it didn't go off. And these are the sort of things that happen. It's all instantaneous, you know. And we just simply laugh about it afterwards. You see, we realise what a narrow escape we've had, and it was our good luck.
How did you react during a barrage? What did you feel?
Oh, nothing. It was the accepted thing. You got used to it. It's surprising what you did get used to. And same as when we had recruits out, first of all, where the regiment was being made up because of losses, because you were always losing some. You could never keep your pals for long, because when we went out in the reserve and we reformed again, there were certain people who weren't there on parade, and we knew what had happened. They'd either been wounded and taken down the line, or else they'd been killed. But, you know, it's the sort of thing that you get used to so quickly, because it was constantly repeated, the barrages. It was quite a daily event. Sometimes you go a couple of days without a barrage, and it'd just be occasional machine gun fire. When you could hear the bullets whizzing overhead, then that's why you had to keep your head
down. Did you have different names for the different types of shell? Would you be able to identify them readily?
Yes, you knew exactly what kind. I mean, you could hear the long distance artillery going over. And there was a continuous whine as they went over the top, you know. And and later on, you listened for the bang automatically when they exploded right down in the rear of the line. And
what did you call those? Did you have a name for them?
No, they were long distance shells. And a feature that struck me, left an impression on my mind, was when we got the rookies up, and the first barrage, they were terrified. Seen them laying down in the trench calling out for their mother on odd occasions. You know, they were new. The first barrage was always the worst. Once you got over the first barrage and you were still there, you didn't bother anymore. You just took it in your stride because it was part of the setup.
What did you think of the first barrage that you were in? How did you react?
Well, I wonder what it was all about. I don't know. I can't ever remember, to be quite honest. It wasn't brave, being brave at all. I think it's a question of your nature. how you took a thing, you know. It's like people, they either take things in their stride or they get terrified or panic-stricken or otherwise, but I've just made that way, I suppose. I just didn't, it was soon over, and it was, to me, it was a past episode. Like life's always been, I've always been like that, from a natural angle, I suppose. It's your make-up, really.
As you gained experience with, you know, with being under fire, would that experience give you any ability to tell where a shell was going to land?
Yes, you had a very good idea of, you know, where they were going and what they were. You could identify them, you know.
Would that help you to avoid them?
Oh, yes. You took the necessary protective action and in ducking your head. And if you knew by the sound of it almost where they were coming, the same with bullets. You could tell where firing of bullets were travelling, how far they were above you, you know, or very near. And you reacted accordingly, and you didn't bother if you knew they were, recognised them as being high above you, or anything like that, overhead stuff.
Was it much small arms fire, machine guns?
Yes, it was, constant. Jerry was very, very, what shall I say, it was a characteristic of the Germans that they relied quite a lot on machine gun fire, and I think they had areas, enfilading fire areas, you know, that they covered the place, and you could hear them, you could hear the sounds of as the machine gun swung round. You could tell that they altered in sound when they passed round, and they covered you like that, over like that. I suppose the effect of ours was the same.
Was it much of a threat from German machine gun fire?
It was. You had to watch it because you never knew when they were going to open up, and you had to, you know, keep your heads down as soon as you heard any clatters, just to find out get the feeling of the guns or the fire.
What about when you were sentry? Would you get your head down then?
Yes, you did. And the steel helmets were a great help to us. I think they saved a good many lives, because the bullets would ricochet off those, you know. And you realise that there was a good protective part of your equipment.
Did that ever happen to you, or was it just something you saw?
No, I never. I never got hit in the helmet. The only time that it was at Chapilly Ridge, when I had a very narrow escape, which I mentioned in my letter to my mother.
Did the British fire their machine guns as much as the Germans did?
Yes, well, we had machine gun corps, and they were very effective, you know, and we could only tell by hearing them, not because we could see them. We could never see them. They were always took up the certain positions that were assigned to them as the most strategic place to fire them from and to use them. And they used to move about as a corps. And if there was any attack by the enemy, they were used to very good effect.
What about general rifle fire? Starting with sniping, was sniping much of a threat?
Yes, it was. You always knew where snipers were, because it was generally the best information we got was, and that everybody got, was from the people they got relieved by. Or who we relieved, they'd tell us what to watch out for. It was always passed on. It was a holy of holies that was. The jewel was passed on to the relieving people, the same as when they came to you. You always tipped them off what to watch for. That was usually the NCO's job, and he'd notify the NCOs in charge of the platoons, and they'd pass it on to the men, you see, and we were always warned to watch out for.
Now, you're a tall man. Did you have a problem keeping your head down and avoiding snipers?
I did, yes. I knew I was tall, and I knew I was more exposed than most of them. And I was the tallest chap in our battalion. And that was what the surprising thing was, you know, that you can't tell why you don't get knocked out or affected or hit. How you can really get away with a thing like that when it was the most obvious possibility you know, being the tallest, that you would be more likely to be hit. And you can never understand why you don't. In the case, as in my case, I didn't. And of course, consequently, you just think somebody's got it looking after your lucky star, as it were.
Did you make a conscious effort to keep your head down then? Did you?
Oh yes, yeah. Well, it was instinctive then. That's what happened. Well, when there was casualties, you see, you got you amongst you. You got people knocked out on your trenches there, who were not cautious enough, or else didn't listen to what they were told, and they took silly chances, and they paid for it. And you couldn't take chances in a place that were not with a foe like Jerry. He was a good soldier.
Can you remember any close escapes or any casualties suffered from King
Only Circle? That one with a shell stuck in the back of the trench, that left an instance in my mind. And
but nothing from particular sniping, no?
No, we never. We had certain parts of the trenches where we couldn't go when it was so shallow that... Yeah, that's why places like Hellfire Corner and all those sort of places, you know, that where that part of the trench was very exposed, and there was no possible way of protecting it from a vision point of view to the enemy, and you just had to do, you know, the usual thing that you were always warned about, let's crawl along there instead of stooping even. That's how bad some of it was.
Did you ever do any sniping or firing yourself?
No.
Any just general firing?
Did you only general firing? That's all. And you know, I think particular people were selected as snipers for sniping work, and I was never called upon to do any of it. Although I was a marksman. You know, I got my across guns and early on. And
would you have been keen to be a sniper?
I don't know. I was never asked, to be honest. It never occurred to me. I was one of those that if I was told to do anything, I just did it, and that was the end of it. I didn't feel any preference or anything for anything at all. It was just, to me, it was a strange experience, and it was quite new, and there was nothing I could call upon to affect my expectancy or otherwise, if you can understand what I mean.
When would you fire your rifle, and under what circumstances would there be
only if you saw something suspicious in when you were standing to? That was the only time you fired your rifle.
And what would, can you give an example?
Well, a morning stand to normally was missed. It was a common feature of France. I think it was due to the state of the ground and the chalons with water in. And
so you'd fire into the mist, would you?
Well, in the mist used to move. And if there was bushes, a small bush, it could look like moving objects. And then I got told off for opening fire when I was using a machine gun on one occasion. When the sergeant came along and wanted to know what the hell I was firing at. I said, I thought it was somebody there moving about. Of course, he said, that's a bush, we know about that.